Well, the next assignment we're going to do is number 15, which is Rachel and Jim, and you'll find it on page 181 of your textbook. And it states as follows. Rachel was assaulted by Jim, a wealthy entrepreneur. Everybody know what an entrepreneur is. An entrepreneur is somebody who owns a business like Donald Trump and goes out and entrepreneurs and builds the business. She suffered skin abrasions, bruises, and a black eye. Rachel has filed a suit against Jim for both general and punitive damages. Now, why do you suppose that she's suing Jim based on what legal theory? Well, upon assault and battery, correct? And the reason that she's suing not only for general damages, which would be for her pain and suffering, but also for punitive damages, is to what? To punish him and to make example. That's what they call exemplary punitive damages, is to punish a person who intentionally does something wrong. Why? Because by punishing, by taking money out of their pocket, by awarding substantial punitive damages, you're basically slapping the person on the wrist and saying this conduct is not acceptable. So Jim cannot just go up and punch and hurt Rachel intentionally. Now, if it happened to be by negligence, in other words, he slipped and fell, and then as he was slipping and falling, he accidentally held on to her and they both fell down and then she injured herself, then she could sue him for his stupidity, for his what I call common garden variety negligence or stupidity. That's what we call negligence. But you can't punish a person for being stupid or awkward. I mean, they just are not, they just violated a general duty of reasonable care. In other words, they were not reasonable in what they did. But the difference between negligence and what intentional tort, and the assault and battery is intentional tort, is that behind an intentional tort you have the evil intention of the person to harm. And then based on that evil harm, then you should punish the person and take money out of their pockets by awarding punitive damages. All right? So Rachel has filed suit against Jim for both general punitive damages. To be awarded punitive damages, Rachel must show that Jim's conduct was intentional and malicious. Jim has claimed that he went into a rage upon seeing Rachel with another man and that he lost control and assaulted her without ever forming an intent to hurt her. Rachel wants to introduce the following evidence to support her claim that Jim acted premeditatedly, intentionally, and maliciously. A, Jim's diary in which he recorded Rachel's whereabouts several times each week for the previous 3 months. Is this admissible? Answer is, yes, Jim's diary is admissible as a recorded recollection of his observations under hearsay exception 8035. So I direct your attention to page number 253 of your textbook, Federal Rule of Evidence 8035 says recorded recollection, a memorandum or record concerning a matter about which a witness once had knowledge but now has insufficient recollection to enable the witness to testify fully and accurately, shown to have been made or adopted by the witness when the matter was fresh in the witness's memory, and to reflect that knowledge correctly. Now, what does that mean? It means that suppose he says to himself, I went into this rage, and if I went into the rage, how could I be intentionally, premeditatedly trying to hurt her? Is that a good argument? Yeah, you bet that's a good argument. Because he could argue that the rage came up, it took over his rationality, right? And part of criminal matters is what we call the state of mind that the person is in. Because in order to assess a criminal penalty and not take away the person's freedom, we have to show that the person had the mens rea. Mens means the mind, and the rea, the specific mind, the specific intention. And what Rachel is arguing is that he was sitting there premeditatedly designing to hurt her, that he actually thought about it ahead of time. And he says, oh no, it was this incredible passion that came up. Why? Because he happened to be jealous. He saw her with another man. So therefore, that would mitigate or lessen this idea of premeditation. But we happen to have a recorded recollection that happens to be before the fact. Now, first of all, what's the credibility of, why is it important to say that that recorded recollection is trustworthy? Because, first of all, it's recorded back when, again, no fabrication, no premeditation. He was doing this as a regular course, just like a public record is done in regular course. Recorded recollection is every day he's writing his diary. What is the importance of the fact that in his diary he says that I keep on following Rachel? What is that? What's the relevance of that? What does that prove? It goes to prove if he's following her, he is stalking her. And if he's stalking her, then he's got in his mind premeditated an intention
to hurt her,
sexually assault her, possibly sexually harass her, or just non-sexually assault and battery. So in other words, the recorded record, if you're sitting as a person in the trial and you see both Rachel and Jim and you go, Jim's pretty believable, I want to believe him, he looks like he's pretty believable, I'm not sure if I really want to believe Rachel because, you know, maybe she, you know, was going out on him and doing the, you know, there was this whole thing going on with this other guy. And then the plaintiff brings in, tries to admit, you know, this recorded recollection. How do they get it? By discovery. They say, please produce, just like in the seminar today, produce the diary, and he's got to produce the diary. So then they admit that into evidence. He says, it's hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement that's used for the truth of, because it's trying to show the truth that he had premeditation, therefore it's hearsay. In fact, it is hearsay. But there's an exception to it. Why? Because it's recorded earlier, therefore not premeditated, and he did it on a regular basis, therefore it's believable. All right? So that's it. Everybody understand that with respect to Jim's diary, the answer is yes, the diary is admissible, and the hearsay exception is 803B, recorded recollection. So remember I told you about facts and law? When you write this analysis down, you quote the law, 803B5, recorded recollection, and then you quote the fact that it was a diary, that's the fact, and that he kept it, and in the diary, he showed what? This, again, these are the things that I look for. I look for 803B, which is the law. I use the recorded recollection. I'm looking for those keywords, and then I'm looking for the facts of a diary, and in the diary, there was what? A statement that he was doing what?
Stalking her.
So when I see those elements, I see the weave going on, and I see that you as a student are putting together the combination of the facts and the law, and I go, yeah, they understand the principles, because not only do they understand the law, but they also understand how the facts weave together with the law.
See, I have a question. In a case like this, in discovery, what if you don't know that the party has a diary? Could you already make a demand for a diary, just to assuming that you could have a diary? Do you have that power?
Well, first of all, remember, we're going to have to make some assumptions or speculations here. They live together, we'll assume, and therefore she knew that he did this diary. Mm-hmm. That's probably most likely what happened. So therefore, it's not... Pardon?
It's like in our mock trial, we could say, well, Jones, we're requesting that you produce a diary, if not, you have one. Is that possible?
Yeah. If you have a reason to believe, even if you have no reason to believe, you might speculate, well, I wonder if he has a diary, and you could say, I want him to produce the diary. Now, you might say, well, if he's, you know, truthful, he might do it, but what's the chance that he's going to deliver a diary? And the answer is this, is that so many times we try to cover things up, and we think we're really smart, and then he's out about, and he's talking to another girlfriend, and he says to her, God, you know what, I have this diary, I was writing pictures and all kinds of stuff, and guess what? The person happens to be, she happens to be a friend of a friend of a friend, and she happens to go out with a friend, and she's talking, she says, you know, I was talking to Jim, and he told me about the diary, bingo. All of a sudden it goes back, you know, big ears, and it goes back to Rachel's attorneys, and now Rachel has reason to believe, and says, produce that document. Now the attorneys tell Jim, you got to produce it, because if you don't, then you're going to be cross-examined and your credibility is going to look like even worse, right? So we're going to argue that it's hearsay and won't get in. And so if they're very effective, you know, if they're really effective with the judge, they'll try to convince them that it's hearsay and that it wasn't a recorded recollection, and therefore it doesn't get in. So it's better to be truthful and then try to win on hearsay than to try to cover it up. You see the difference? All right. So that, remember the answer number one then is Jim, yes, it's an admissible document, and it's under 803.5. All right, B, a note written by Jim to his secretary telling her, this would be who, her telling the secretary, to send flowers to Rachel with the message, I'll be watching you. All right, again, the I'll be watching you, is that an out-of-court statement? Answer is yes. Is it used for the truth of the matter, photomat of the matter asserted therein? Yes. Why? Because what are we trying to use that statement to show? I'll be watching you is the premeditation that supports the intentional battery, therefore the punitive damages. So is it potentially hearsay? Yes. And the answer is, Jim's note written to his secretary is admissible as a non-hearsay statement of a party opponent. I'll be watching her is an admission against his own interest. The idea is that a person who is truthful does not admit that they did something criminal, because if they're truthful, then they admit the truth instead of covering it up. If somebody's not truthful, they're not going to admit that they did something wrong, right? So that's the believability. So a party's opponent statement is non-hearsay because it is defined under 801D2. So this is not a hearsay exception. Then this is a technicality, because you might say, well, what's the difference between non-hearsay and hearsay exception? And the reason is that the court just decides, as a matter of public policy, that it's not even a statement, and therefore it's non-hearsay. So what I like to see here, again, is the quoting. I love to see when the student writes down the rule, and here it's 801D2 of the Federal Rule of Evidence. It's also admissible for the non-hearsay purpose of showing Jim's state of mind. Remember, we were talking about state of mind? Finally, it is admissible for the non-hearsay purposes of impeaching Jim's testimony. Why? Because he said he never formed a premeditated intent to harm her, and now you can do what? Use it to impeach his credibility. God bless you.
Thank you.
So, it can be used, remember, you can use a statement to impeach, right? You can almost use any statement you want to impeach the credibility. Why is it? Because when you're impeaching the credibility, you're not really using it for the truth. You're just showing that a person said yes and no at the same time, and one of those has to be a lie. Right? Finally, his statement about watching her might well be considered a prior inconsistent statement for impeachment purposes, even though it is not directly contradictory to his statement that he never formed an intent to hurt Rachel. So the bottom line here, 801D2, non-hearsay. All right, number C, a note written by Jim's secretary to the company operator saying, Jim says to make sure that any calls from Rachel are put directly through to him. Now the problem with this is what we call double hearsay. It's hearsay within hearsay. It is the secretary's out-of-court statement quoting Jim's out-of-court statement. So in essence, it's two hearsays. You have Jim's secretary, which is hearsay, and then Jim's own statement, which is hearsay. The secretary would have to be called to testify about the note in order for the evidence contained in the note to be admissible. So her hearsay is hearsay without an exception. However, the note may be used to refresh the secretary's recollection as to what Jim said. So if you bring in the secretary and you try to admit her technical out-of-court statement, it's double hearsay. But if you say to her, look, do you remember what Jim said? No, I really don't remember. Well, if I show you this recorded, you know, this written statement, you know, that you have in a deposition or whatever, will that refresh your memory? And then she says, yes, now I remember exactly what happened. All right, so the bottom line here is just to state that the note written by the secretary is hearsay without any exception, so double hearsay.
And it is admissible?
Well, it's inadmissible because it's
not.
If the secretary testifies, Jim's statement is admissible to show a state of mind. Remember, her statement out of court is technical hearsay, but when Jim is saying, Jim says, make sure that any calls from Rachel are put directly through to him. Now, what's the relevance of having this secretary put any calls, make sure that any calls from Rachel are put directly through to him. What's the relevance of that?
I don't see it. Because it could be anything, like if they're just dating instead of stalking.
What would be, remember that every particular piece of fact has what we call inferences. And you and I might be on one side, you might be on the other side, we can draw different inferences. And what is an inference? An inference is basically taking a piece of evidence, circumstantial evidence, and drawing, an inference is a conclusion, is drawing an implication or a conclusion. So think about it. If I say to you, I want every single call to be put through.
This isn't saying
what does it mean? It means, yes, exactly. Basically, it means that if Jim is in the middle of another conversation and he says, always interrupt me because I have to talk to Rachel, the common thing would be, look, if I'm in an important meeting, just tell Rachel, she'll live, that I'm going to call her back. But to say, I'm going to drop everything, then it goes to show obsession. Now, why is that? What's the inference? What's the implication behind a person being obsessive? The answer is that if they're obsessive, that then they're premeditated, mm-hmm. and the premeditation then goes to the conclusion or implication is that supports the stalking. The stalking then supports the fact that he intentionally harmed. You see how you link together these implications. Now, it's kind of like what you're trying to do is you're trying to give enough information to the jury so that the jury goes, and they start to figure it out themselves. They go, there's something weird. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they compare it with their own kind of like what they do. And they think, how do I act? Now, it's true that I really love to talk to my wife or my husband, but there's a lot of times I'm really busy and unless it's important. One time, I don't know if I told you this, one time I told my sons, don't do a 911. It used to be in the old days of pagers, right? So I was standing in class here, and it was a 911. I'm like, oh my God. So I pull out my cell phone right in the middle of class, because I think my son's in the middle of an accident. And I call him up. He says, Dad, on your way home, would you get, some McDonald's, bring McDonald's home? I said, that's not a 911. That's a 411. That's like for your information, Dad. You know, if it's a 411, then I know, okay, I'll call him when I'm out of class.
He was hungry.
But, I mean, hey, McDonald's, 911. He would be a good advertisement, for McDonald's, right? So anyway, the statement by Jim put all the calls through, we could argue that it's his state of mind. And because it's a state of mind, it's not so much for the truth, but it goes to show his obsession, and therefore it's not a hearsay. Because it shows, remember, when we're proving the state of mind, if a person says, I am the King of England, right? And you know that obviously they're not the King of England, then we're not using it for the truth. We're not trying to prove that he's lying or that he is, in fact, the King of England. All we know is that the guy's pretty whacked out because people that say I'm the King of England, they're either a pretty funny comic or they're stupid or they're just whacked out.
So the rule of evidence for C would be?
So for the answer here is that you have double hearsay, right? Mm-hmm. Hearsay within hearsay. The secretary's statement is hearsay without any exception, but Jim's statement is state of mind and therefore non-hearsay. All right, that's number C. Number D, testimony by Rachel's friend that Rachel repeatedly told her that she was frightened of Jim. Rachel's friend's testimony is hearsay if it's offered on direct examination. If Rachel is excited and upset when she told her fears, then what would that be called? If she's excited, it would be called an excited utterance under 803.2. So what I like to see here, going back to our weave analysis, is statement of the rule 803.2, and the fact would be what? Repeatedly told her that she was frightened, and therefore frightened would be what? Potentially she did it when she was excited, therefore an excited utterance. Otherwise, the testimony is inadmissible, right? Everybody got that one? On number D?
So, will it be inadmissible, or will it be able to plead?
It's generally inadmissible, but if we could show that she was excited when she was talking to her friend. You know, remember O.J. Simpson, and you had Nicole Simpson, and she called in 911, and she said, he's going to kill me. Mm-hmm. That would be an excited utterance, right?
Yeah.
So if you can show... What?
This one doesn't sound like it.
No, it doesn't sound like it. But if you're on the part of the plaintiff and you're trying to get this in, if you're trying to get it in, you're going to make the argument anyway, right? You may not win this argument, right? All right, so that now concludes our coverage of assignment number 15, the application question of Rachel and Jim on page 181 of your textbook.